Welcome to Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
And hey, I met you. You are not cool.
With me, as always, is professional film critic, Sean Patrick.
I am too smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
You goddamn communist heathen, you had best sound off that you love the Virgin Mary, or I'm going to stomp your guts out. Now, you do love the Virgin Mary, don't you?
Visit us at IHateCritics.net. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handles there is Critics Pod. There you can check out our top fives, watch the trailers, read the news, interact. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play. No matter where you listen to us, please go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the show, write and review the show. We will read it on the air. We haven't had one in a while, so if you could do that, please help us out that way. And also tell your friends. Let's grow the podcast a little bit. It's fun that way. What am I forgetting? Patreon. IHateCritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to help support the podcast. If you do that, you'll get a credit on the show. There's selective merchandise. There's bonus podcasts, currently singular, and other things that go along with it. And we have a Facebook group that we never plug. I think it's Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I think I did change the name of that.
Yes, you did.
If you go to there, you'll see everything we post. I think I have the page and the group linked. We don't promote that enough, but it can be fun whenever we're there. We had some He-Man fun a couple weeks ago.
It no longer has a Star Wars picture on it, so we're good to go.
What's the picture now? Or is it just blank?
It's our logo.
Oh, you put it up? Cool. I didn't.
No, somebody did.
I did link them. Maybe that did automatically then. Or Jason might have done it. I don't know.
Who knows?
Jason from New Mexico helped us. I think he actually didn't help us. He flat out created the page.
Unofficial admin.
But yeah, it's a fun place to go. Let's start with, we'll go with trailers. And one I didn't see called Mowgli.
Mowgli. This is the dark and gritty version of the Jungle Book. Directed by Andy Serkis, so that's something. I mean, Andy Serkis is certainly an interesting guy. But do we need dark and gritty Jungle Book? Is that something the world needs?
I didn't need a Jungle Book movie, let alone two films that would necessitate a reboot and a gritty reboot. No, I didn't. The trailer itself, it's fine. If we didn't have Jon Favreau's Jungle Book, then this one, I suppose, would be a fine substitute. But it always struck me as odd that they were making two, because at the time that the Disney Jungle Book one was announced, the Warner Brothers one had been announced as well. And you can have competing films, like competing shark films, volcano films, disaster, you know, whatever. But why in the world would you want to put the same story against each other, you know? Because I think the Disney one was successful enough that, why would you want to do that again?
Is the Jungle Book in the public domain?
Good question. I mean, that would mean, is Rudyard Kipling's stuff in the public domain? Yeah. Maybe.
That's a weird question, but I'm only interested is if this happens, if like in the first 10 minutes he meets the bear and he just shoots him in the face, instead of they becoming friends. Then it's the dark and gritty version.
Is that in the trailer?
I think we convinced him that it was in the trailer.
I didn't watch it. I mean, I'm all for
make up what the dark and gritty version of this is, and Bob will believe it.
Because I didn't watch it. I wouldn't know. I mean, I didn't believe you fucked the snake. Like you said. But I'm all for dark and gritty. I mean, technically, if you think about it, everybody's life's rated R because everybody swears and everybody has sex for the most part. Everybody does, you know, play, you know, everybody lives rated R.
There are certain corners of Reddit that would disagree with you on whether or not they're having sex.
Well, fine. Corners. but, you know, life is dark and gritty. So I'm all for making everything dark and gritty, or at least a version of it. But I don't.
Dark and gritty Minions coming next summer.
Minions aren't real, though.
Minions just start fucking the entire time.
How? Why am I thinking of these things?
You're not. He is.
I merely put it in your head.
Successfully.
Quite successfully.
All right, let's move on to another trailer. The Happy Time Murders, Red Band.
Yeah, this does nothing for me. And I'll tell you why. No, it's because I blame YouTube, because I've watched multiple people talk about puppet pornography, basically. Like, there's a movie made in the 70s called Let My Puppets Come. Like, and it's literally just puppet porn. And so I'm not really shocked. This didn't shock me. This didn't do anything for me. I love Melissa McCarthy, though, and I'm sure she's going to swear in that one, so I'll be impressed by that. That I can look forward to, but nothing in the Red Band really just – nothing moved me. That whole extended bit with the puppets fucking, and then he comes and he's spraying silly string everywhere, it was not particularly funny.
Question is, did they have silly string in the original? According to Google, silly string was invented in 1972, so if they don't have that as part of the thing, then okay, at least this is somewhat inventive.
Wait, no, is this a time period specific movie?
No, I was talking about the one that you said was from the 70s.
No, I'm talking about this. No, that scene's in the Red Band trailer for this movie.
Well, no, right. He's saying, did the version you're talking about have silly string in it or not?
Yes. No.
Cursory research of a Google question told me that information, but this reminds me, and I laughed because I know your thoughts on Team America World Police,
right,
which I just absolutely love, and I feel like this is in the same vein as that. Maybe a little more reined in, though, because this is Brian Henson directing this. He's the son of Jim, am I not mistaken? I mean, that's fantastic. You just get that feeling that every once in a while you wanted one of the puppets themselves wanted to say something. I mean, they couldn't handle Gonzo's bullshit or whatever, and one of them said, Jesus fucking Christ, Gonzo, come on! You know, you're wasting all of our production budget on your bazookas or your cannons. I'm sure that Kermit wanted to say that. This is all that stuff that wanted to come out when you watch the Muppets, so to speak. Bob?
Yeah, like dark and grittier Muppets.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, I'm not, I guess I wasn't shocked per se, because Team America alone, you're not going to, that's already shocking by itself. And I like Melissa McCarthy, I like Maya Rudolph, I like Elizabeth Banks. I'm definitely interested to see what this is. And then Bohemian Rhapsody.
I'm in for this because Rami Malek is so good, but I am concerned about the things that I've been reading about, the things that people have been discussing about this movie. I think it's an exceptional trailer, but I am concerned if they're you can't downplay the fact that he was bisexual or even that he was mostly homosexual. You can't downplay that and pretend that wasn't part of his life. And if that's what they're going to do with this movie, and that's basically what Brian May apparently has been pushing for, is to don't focus on Freddie's life, focus on the music. Well, he was. I think that's all part of it, really, wasn't it? The person makes the music, and to ignore that part of his life, pretend, and especially they're going to pretend they're just going to cut it off apparently before he dies, or not go into what happened to him. Like, that seems like a pretty big dramatic portion that you're going to leave out of this guy's story.
I don't know. Straight Outta Compton ignored a lot, and everybody loved that. So I could see. I guess it would depend. If it's just about the music, I don't mind that because that's all I really care about with Queen. I'm not the biggest Queen fan, but I do like some of their songs, and I'd be more interested in that part of it than any other part of it. I'm not saying.
But I mean, do you want a documentary where they're just in the studio writing songs?
Are you talking to me or the average person?
I'm talking to you. I mean, if it's focused on the music, what does focused on the music mean?
I just. Figuring out how Bohemian Rhapsody came together alone is probably more interesting than anything else in any of their personal lives, you know?
Yeah, and that was the part of the trailer that was interesting to me is, oh, I wonder if that's how it really happened. Queen themselves, it was like the first group that had any difference than classic rock or whatnot that I listened to. And in Bohemian Rhapsody was introduced to me via watching Wayne's World. Like, I didn't grow up with them with a lot that a lot of my peers, like you guys, may have grown up with
it was
Queen
Wayne's
music.
World for me too.
Okay,
I mean,
okay.
I knew We Will Rock You and Another One Bites the Dust and We Are the Champions. That's about it. And then Wayne's World happened, and then Everybody got into Queen.
I'm not looking for some full-on Brokeback Mountain shit. I just want the people to be true to who this guy was. That's all I'm asking for.
Well, if they lie, that's one thing. I don't know. If it's a great movie, but they don't mention or spend a whole lot of the time on him being gay or bisexual, that's not fair to a good movie. I don't know. That's all I'm saying. If it's bad and they don't do that, or if that makes it bad, that's another thing.
I mean, if you're just going to portray who he is, though, I mean, there are aspects of his story that are just part of who he was.
Well, I understand that, I mean, but there's a bunch of guys in the band.
Part of John Lennon's story is the fact that he loved Yoko Ono. You wouldn't make a Beatles movie and then go, well, you know, that Yoko shit, that didn't matter.
My big problem with Straight Outta Compton was they tried to put too much in it. They left a lot of important stuff out, specifically a lot of the abusive stuff. There's such a big timeline. You just, you know, you pick a piece of it and you do it. So, he's not the only one in the band either on top of that. So you have a lot to cover in there. So it's not crucial to me that it's in there as long as you're not hiding from it either.
But Freddie Mercury is the star of this movie. Rami Malek is the star of this movie playing Freddie Mercury. Maybe called Bohemian Rhapsody, but tell me the name of the guy who's playing Brian May without looking it up.
I don't need to. Brian May is my favorite.
Not Mike Myers, who apparently is in the movie.
The movie's about Rami Malek. It's about Freddie Mercury and who Freddie Mercury was and what went into being Freddie Mercury and making the music of Queen.
Well, we can have this discussion when that happens.
It's not in there, yeah.
I'm more interested too in how this managed to get completed over time. Bryan Singer walked away from the project or was kicked off of it or something along those lines, or there's something there that I don't know the information to that's probably widely available on the internet, but the IMDb lists two directors, and I remember a piece of news saying that Singer was working on it, and then there were clashes with the cast and production and whatnot, and it makes me wonder what actually happened. Was he trying to do what you were hoping for, and then they kind of said, nah, we don't want you to do that.
Or was he having things come out against him?
Yeah, also true.
There were allegations against him that are still out there that have not been dismissed.
Aha.
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in it just from the musical part of it, but I'm just curious where it'll go. And if it sucks and they totally abandon it, I'm not going to defend it.
Yeah.
But it just...
There's a story out there that's floating around about Sacha Baron Cohen and why he left. And that story is a little bit... if it's true, if it's the true story, and he's not saying much, but there's just a lot of rumors about him walking away because they didn't want to tell the story right.
Well, it's probably for the best as well, because he's considerably older than a young Freddie Mercury. I don't know. But he looks good in the role, and I'm interested, at least. And then, let's see. Jake Gyllenhaal is trying to resurrect his career.
He has not
made a good movie in a while. He has been, probably for 2 or 3 years, it's been kind of down. He's been okay in the movies.
When you're that high, though. Like
he was never that high, though, either. He was like an indie high, but he was never like high. And Nightcrawler was the last good thing he's done. And that's been a couple years. Tell me one. Name one. Say it out loud.
Stronger was a really good movie.
We're talking about success.
Okay, sure.
I mean, I know in this show, I believe we've referred to him as arguably the best actor working today.
We spent a lot harder. We were harder on that 3 years ago. Yeah. But we've kind of abandoned that a little bit.
Yeah, Nightcrawler was 2014. I didn't realize that until I started looking at it. But
Stronger
okay.
was just, what, last year?
But again, not a huge success.
Man, you're right. He was in Okja,
is incredible.
Okay, that's a Netflix-based film out of Japan, China, something along those lines. He was in Life, which is a piece of garbage.
Yeah.
Nocturnal Animals. Okay, that was a good movie, but also more along the indie side. Okay, and he wasn't necessarily
like
the lead.
Big indie movie either. And I mean, Southpaw, it was bad, but he was good in it. I mean, I'm not saying he's throwing a blockbuster out there is all I'm saying, which he hasn't had in a long time.
Fair. The good part about this, of course, is that he's been in this genre rumored for like 15 years.
Well, he was going
to
be Spider-Man.
You want to go back to about 20 years ago, he was going to be Spider-Man, and then the Batman rumors. And at this point, I would absolutely love to see him in anything because he's such a good actor. He's going to find a layer to any character that he plays and bring it up a little bit. No offense to any of the Spider-Man villains before, but like Jamie Foxx's Electro isn't necessarily something we remember, or Paul Giamatti as Rhino, stuff like that. This, I think, he could bring a higher level to. And I don't know a whole lot about Mysterio other than he wears a globe. And he's something of an illusionist.
He wears a globe?
Yeah, you should see the figure. Well, okay, I'm not going to go down that route. But look at the design of the character. And he wears like a globe, almost like a gypsy's, you know, ball. The mirror, you know what I'm saying. Words.
And then Lars von Trier, people walked out of his movies at Con or whatever, and A24 picked it up, I think.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I don't know.
The house that Jack built. I have read some really, really disturbing things about this movie.
Count me in.
Yep, I'm on board.
Well, I say that, but I've never seen Antichrist, so.
Neither have I. That should definitely be something we explore.
But you have seen Nymphomaniac 1 and 2.
Yes. But that's actually a solid movie. I mean, there's nothing wrong with them.
And it wasn't quite as provocative as I was thinking it would be. In fact, Neon Demon is far more provocative to me than Nymphomaniac. And people could have been lured into a false sense of security going into Neon Demon, not knowing what they were about to see. I think he's just a provocative filmmaker. And the article that I read about him this week was telling in that you can almost be too quick to write something off before we see it. If afterwards we see it and we say, come on, this really didn't have a point, this is just gore for gore's sake or whatnot, then we can make that judgment. But as of right now, the article has a point. Hollywood is really the leveler for all things provocative and shocking, and it's through that prism that it reflects on society at the time. It's not necessarily Lars von Trier is sick. He may just be, but we said the same thing about a lot of other filmmakers, and they've done a lot of positive things.
And I mean, if I remember right, Antichrist had a lot of this crap when that came out, and then it seems like over time people are starting to kind of, I don't know if they're saying it's a classic or by any means, I haven't seen it, but it does seem to get more positive reviews now than it did at the time when it came out, so whatever that's worth. I don't know. Deadpool 2.
Okay, Deadpool 2 is directed by
Ryan Reynolds.
David Leitch?
David Leitch, thank you. I was forgetting his first name. The director of Atomic Blonde. This picks up the story of Deadpool. He's now out doing as much killing his bad guys as he can and coming home to his beautiful girlfriend. Something happens to change that and then sends him on his journey in this movie, which will eventually lead to a conversation with Cable, played by Josh Brolin, as a time traveler who's come back in time to kill a mutant child who in the future will be doing something that, well, I don't want to spoil that, but basically Cable's trying to kill a kid, Deadpool's trying to stop him. That dynamic will also shift, and those are really strong shifts. What everybody wants to know, though, is this movie funny? And yes, it's very, very funny. I like this movie. I like it a lot. I like the first movie better. I think the first movie achieves something that this movie doesn't, and that is just that it has its own rhythm. Everything in the first Deadpool had its own very peculiar rhythm to it that was so unconventional. The way the voiceover could go from being a voiceover to being dialogue so swiftly and so smoothly and so in a way that you don't expect it. It goes from his inner monologue to being this outer monologue that he's talking to us. He's talking to other characters. He's back in his head. And so smoothly that you almost don't even notice that he's doing it. And the pace of that movie was so good. What's interesting about this one is that it's just nearly just as good, but it's a far more conventional action movie. It has far more structure. David Leitch is a much more of a typical director, and he takes Deadpool and kind of structures it in a way that is kind of more typical of a of another action movie, and that's only what basically just places it just a little bit behind the original Deadpool, is that it doesn't have that same pace, it doesn't have that same unusual feel. It feels more conventional. There are times when it slows down a little bit, or it becomes a the beats are just a little bit slower than the original, and that's the only thing that holds it back from me liking it as much as the first one.
I guess the question is it good or is it great? I'll just say the experience was great. It's so much fun that I don't really care that it's conventional, because, I mean, Ryan Reynolds has no handcuffs on this one either, and makes it amazing. And it doesn't really matter to me how good the movie is. Josh Brolin does a good job of being the straight guy. What's her name? Domino steals the movie, or steals some scenes. The whole X-Force thing was fantastic. The mid-credits scene was probably the best part of the movie, which in a lot of ways, if you did something to make this like a phenomenal movie, which they could have done, Logan, like the way Logan did, that wouldn't have happened. But I don't care. This is so much fun that none of that really matters to me. And I feel like, you know, the directors did switch, and I really do think if the original guy stayed on, it wouldn't be as good as this one is. Even though the first one is better, yes, I think he wanted to, he was kicked off for a reason, and I think they needed to kind of stick with what they were doing, even if they went more conventional this time.
Sure. These two movies here exist in their own way anyways, and so I can't belittle its form or shape or anything like that too much. And I enjoyed the movie too. I don't think it's as good as the first one, but the element of surprise gave the first one such a high bar compared to this. It was going to be hard to reach that anyways. I found myself laughing out loud, sorry Bob, a number of times. And
so fucking annoying.
I do have an annoying laugh. See, you're hearing it right now, but there was something a little off about how they held emotion sometimes in this film. It was slightly awkward. Scene transitions weren't as fluid as the first time. I would argue that I agree that Tim Miller shouldn't necessarily have gotten a chance to do this again, because it's hard to replicate that thing. But David Leitch, I've seen three of his films now. I don't want to see another one. I mean, I'm not interested in... He's not bringing anything new to the table.
Oh, no.
John Wick... I'm sorry, I know everyone likes that so much as an action film, but I was kind of bored. And I was kind of bored by the second one as well. Atomic Blonde let down so much and just kind of threw an 80s song at you to keep you involved. Oh, yeah, I like that song. This one, it's not like that per se, but I feel that the script is so strong, and Ryan Reynolds is so strong. You're going to pay attention to him no matter what. And so I'm forgiving the director for his small ills here, but I just don't think that he necessarily has a voice the way that the first film had a particular voice.
Absolutely. You've perfectly nailed that. Yes, this is what he's done is basically he's played it safe. And that's, again, I like this movie a lot. It's very funny. It's a very funny movie, but there's no real growth here. This is of this story, and there's a way forward, and you can still see where this is going. But there's no and an unbridled Ryan Reynolds is good. I think Ryan Reynolds pretty much probably took over this idea and just kind of ran it himself, as opposed to even allowing, you know, the director's just basically there to shape it and keep it in sort of a recognizable shape that, you know, while he's running around being Dirty Bugs Bunny. I think I would love to have seen what Tim Miller at least had in mind for his version, you know, what he would have done, because I think here's a little bit more of an artist in him from based off the first film. I think he's got a little bit more of an auteur notion, and I think he, as much as he would have left Ryan Reynolds to do the Ryan Reynolds stuff, and he did the first film.
I know, but Ryan Reynolds was part of the reason why he had to leave. So I don't know if that's true. That's where my argument is. Ryan Reynolds was more important than what Tim Miller, is that his name? Mm-hmm. In my opinion, and that's where it seemed like you had to kind of choose one or the other, based on the news that when we report it when it happened.
Sure thing. Ryan Reynolds even gets a screenplay credit here.
I would have loved to have seen at least what Tim Miller had in mind because again, I do think based off of that first film that he is a guy. He's a guy who has a very unique vision, and I would have loved to have at least seen him get a chance. But that said, this is a good movie. It just I wish there had been something more of an evolution of the form of Deadpool as opposed to just here's a bunch of really funny stuff and it works as a story.
Yeah.
If you're at all interested in trying to piece together this cinematic X-Men universe, I don't know why you would do that because you'd just drive yourself crazy all the time. But not only in the first Deadpool did they completely revamp Colossus to be somebody with real speaking roles. They weren't going to get the same actor to play Colossus. I get that one. And in this case, they've got another character that I won't spoil, but that's completely and totally different than the first time they brought this character around. And
way
you can,
better.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But I just kept thinking to myself, well, you know, this is when I kind of check out of the X-Men movies, though, because the as much argument as we want to have, say, like Terrence Howard to Don Cheadle or Iron Man 3 to this, you know, oh, all of a sudden he's got the suit back on. All the little nitpicky things that we want to say about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In this case, this is so freaking blatant, like the difference between the characters, between different films. It's like Simon Kinberg and his entire posse of X-Men people just say, yeah, whatever, nobody cares anyways, they're going to come see it. And they just take such liberty with your own investment in the series.
But the fact that he's pretty much saying it to you as well while they're taking liberties, he's pointing it out.
Also true, which, yes.
And it's not so much a universe on the X-Men side as it is the Avengers side either. You know,
they think it is.
No, those Wolverine movies are almost outside the universe in a little way.
You're right. They end up being that, but they are still part of the universe. They still tell you about timelines and characters that are there. X-Men Origins Wolverine, you've got Emma Frost sitting there as a teenager, and then all of a sudden in 1960-something, she's January Jones. Like, wait, hold on a second. You went back 20 years in time, and all of a sudden she's an adult. I just stopped caring. Like, that's why Deadpool is so necessary to this franchise. It lets you have a little fun with it. It eases the entire playing field out. You know, even having no Logan involved with Deadpool, so to speak, or having Deadpool screwed up the first time. We've pretty much forgotten about that, right? I mean, because we have two solid Deadpool films.
Did you know the character you mentioned that we're not going to spoil? Do you know who played him?
This time around?
Yeah.
Is this a Infinity War situation?
It was a vocal performance for the most part, but it was Ryan Reynolds.
No kidding.
No kidding. Ryan Reynolds played that character.
Oh, so the original actor was too busy, huh? Sure.
Was that his butt then?
I believe it may have been.
Fantastic.
At least the model of it, yes. Did you catch the other two?
Yes.
Two cameos that were in this movie? Major big star cameo.
Definitely that big star cameo.
They're
the
both
other
big
one.
Stars. One was talking about toilet paper. His name's Matt.
Matt Damon is in Deadpool 2.
No!
On the back of the pickup truck? Him and the dude from Dale and Tucker vs.
Alan Tudyk.
Whatever.
Oh, that's him! I pointed out Alan Tudyk, but didn't notice Matt Damon.
He was so made up that I didn't notice it in the moment. I saw it later.
I lean over and I say, hey, it's Alan Tudyk. Not noticing one of the world's largest movie stars to the left. Whoops.
And that other cameo, I keep waiting for other people to react to it because I've been to the movie a couple times now, and nobody else seems to laugh when they see that big cameo.
It's
like,
so fast.
It is, but like, how are you missing it?
Because it's like, that, huh? I mean, that's your reaction. It's not really like, haha, that's Brad, or whatever. I mean, it made $120 million worldwide. So,
I will say again another point in this film's favor ahead of the original just a little bit is that I did get genuinely choked up at one moment.
Yeah,
like at the very end, and he's in that sort of fantasy universe that or universe between life and death, whatever it is, and
it was the Take on Me video.
That's
what it was.
Yeah,
basically. If you think about it.
And that song is perfect. The way that they break down that song is amazing. That remake of that song is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that moment is like genuinely like I got choked up.
I got both because part of me is thinking it's hilarious that they're playing Take On Me while the comic book character is trying to get into the... You know, but at the same time, it's really a sad moment. Just the way they kind of weave the two together, I thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And part of me wants him to stay on that side because that would have just all of a sudden made this a... I think it might have even topped the first one if you had actually had the balls to do that. I'm glad they didn't because I want to see... I could watch a average Deadpool movie forever because it's always going to be funny.
That we agree on, yes. Like I said, this is a very funny movie. That the whole X-Force series of scenes is hysterical and so unexpected. The use of time travel. No movie has used time travel this hilariously.
That's essentially what the next Avengers movie is going to be. I mean, that might be the funniest part of the movie, is that mid-credit scene. And it's already a hilarious movie.
There is a reference to Thanos in this movie, which is great.
Well, it's in the trailer, I think. He calls Josh Brolin Thanos.
Domino's played by Zazie Beetz, who's incredible on Atlanta.
Fantastic.
And I could watch her in her own movie. Yeah, the scene that gets that gets the biggest reaction is the baby legs. That scene is the biggest scene in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking, wait a minute. Coming up, we're probably going to see this, right? No. Oh, they left it alone. No, there it is. Okay.
Yep.
My personal favorite joke was fairly early on when they're in the bar and the big dude flubs line. Right? I was like, no more lines for me. I don't know. That's just one. There's just so many. A lot of them were in the trailer, but there was just constant. I don't know. It is a great experience. It's because I really think any fourth wall breaking movie kind of prevents itself from being like a Citizen Kane, but it's just so much fun that it just doesn't matter to me. I don't know. Any other thoughts on Deadpool 2?
Don't I can take always... your children.
Did you?
No. I told him, even though we're going to get into watching Alien, Terminator, et cetera, in the next 2 to 3 years, perhaps, depending on what I feel his maturity level will be, I'm excited for that, honestly. I've already told him, you've got to be out of the house before you see Deadpool. It's just not going to happen, kid. Sorry.
Oh, man. I was going to see the other movies this weekend, and so many people taking their kids to Deadpool. So many conversations after you knowing what the first one was.
I didn't take him. Quit looking at me. You were there. You know,
right,
I didn't take
him. Right.
He wanted to go really bad. I'm like, sorry.
My favorite almost cameo was that referral back to the first movie. Get the strap on. I'm not sure how that work. I'm not sure that would work, but we'll try. That was great. She's awesome. She's really fantastic.
I did enjoy them calling Josh Brolin a racist the whole time.
That was a good runner. That was a solid runner.
X people. That's the one that really got me cracking up.
Hell, the opening shot of Wolverine lying dead with the stake through him or whatever was fantastic. I don't know, the whole thing. Just
air supply. Yeah. Great use of air supply.
It's a fun movie that, I mean, I guess if you want to sit there and go, that's not funny, anybody can do that to a comedy, I suppose, but it really is, so go see Deadpool 2 if you haven't already. The funniest thing that happened was in the lobby, because I had bought some water. And as I'm buying water, because I'm trying to be vegan and eating healthy and lose weight, and all of a sudden I hear Josh ask Beth, his fiance, girlfriend, whatever. Do you want water? And she's, she goes, water's a waste of money or something like that.
Oh, God, I forget. It,
I turned around. She laughed so loud and so
hard. She got attention from the entire – well, that happens everywhere we go.
It was amazing.
Well, okay, it's a waste of money.
She's absolutely
that,
correct.
Yeah.
Personal sight gag.
But it was just a – maybe it was kind of a had to, you had to be there moment, but it really was hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, trust me, my heart leapt right into my throat, and I think, oh, well – God damn it.
Then Josh apologized for not sitting next to him like, you're with your girlfriend.
Right, right.
But it was very nice of you. I appreciate it.
We always, like, if we're in the same theater, I'm always like, man, I want to sit by Bob, but he's sitting in a shitty seat. I want something that actually centers on the screen for me.
See, that was part of what I knew he liked the center part, but I like a railing. And
oh,
I
even after I insulted
there.
His water purchase, he still let so me have the good seat.
Plus, there were people behind that person, and I should have taken it because the people behind me just kept kicking my chair the
whole
time.
Yeah, he kicked the shit out of my chair towards the end of the movie, so it wasn't always cracked up
I'm
to me.
Sorry.
He could have fit two of you in there.
Yeah, go see a movie with us sometime.
Everybody's coming to Bob's for Sallow next week.
Yes!
Sallow and hot dogs.
Moral It'll be a shitstorm.
I was thinking chili.
Chili dogs. There we go. maybe fishing with Gandhi to cleanse the palate when we're done. All right, book club.
Oh, this is not a palate cleanser. This movie sucks. Just flat out blows. Book club is the story of four elderly women who want to remind everyone that they're still sexually active. They decide during their book club that they're going to read the 50 Shades books, and that leads to various different revelations about their sex lives. Jane Fonda has a very active sex life with numerous partners because she doesn't like relationships. Diane Keaton's husband died a year ago, so she hasn't really gotten back out there in that way. Candace Bergen hasn't had sex in 18 years, according to this movie. She's a judge, and she's thinking about going online dating. And Mary Steenburgen and her husband, Craig T. Nelson, are in a bit of a dry spell, and she's trying to get the magic back. Each of the women get turned on by the book and kind of try and figure out their way around. Jane Fonda gets into a thing with Don Johnson, but is trying to figure out a way to actually sleep next to him as opposed to sleep with him, because she's afraid she'll catch feelings. And Diane Keaton meets a pilot played by Andy Garcia. And everything in the movie is kind of gentle and pleasant until you get really step away from it. And you get the kind of the stupid raunchy parts that are really like unnecessary, I guess. For some reason, like Candace Bergen's cat is deeply affected by the way she uses her vagina. That's a big funny joke in this movie. You've got a sad pussy. I think the veterinarian says something like that.
Ew,
because her cat's not a lethargic pussy is what he says. Because the cat doesn't have any energy. Then she starts fucking Richard Dreyfuss, and suddenly the cat's up and running around. And the cat's got energy again.
After Richard Dreyfuss? Candace, my digits.
It's a metaphor. That you didn't need, because you actually had it happening as well alongside the metaphor.
Yeah.
I love that one. There's a metaphor when there doesn't need to be.
Right.
I think Twilight did that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they did. Oh, man. The gags you've seen are in the trailer, so that you know that, like, Craig T. Nelson gets dosed with Viagra and gets pulled over by a cop, and that's supposed to be funny. Diane Keaton's kids, played by Alicia Silverstone and Aaron Hayes, are like really overprotective. Like they think she's going to fall down. They want to put her in their house so they can take care of her. And
That's not realistic at all.
Not even. No, they're just so, but they take it to such an overbearing degree that, like, she gets away one weekend with Andy Garcia, and they send the police to look for her because they're so worried about her. Because she's old, you see. Old people can't do anything.
How old is she?
She's 72. Oh,
come on.
Andy Garcia is 62.
Help me out here. I haven't seen Godfather Part 3, but does he not play the son of Diane Keaton and Al Pacino?
No. He's a nephew.
Nephew. Okay.
I mean, it's
okay.
Still creepy.
Sure.
if that timelines were meshed, yeah. No, well, he's nephew.
I believe Robert Pattinson has been Reese Witherspoon's son and lover.
All right. Movies. Wraps that up.
I believe they referred to that as a motherfucker, if I'm not. See, that's not funny. That's the kind of joke to be in this movie.
I live with me every but day. It's a low bar.
Yeah, I mean, there's just stuff like that pussycat thing that is just that's the level of humor that you're dealing with in this movie, and it's beneath pretty much everybody involved. You know, there's a chase to the airport at one point, and that's, you know, obviously a hallmark of shitty movies. And yeah, there's a big dance scene at the end, again another hallmark of shitty movies. Yeah, this movie sucks.
But they had a lot of fun making it, and that's all that matters.
And there is zero critique in the 50 Shades thing. Nobody talks about what a shitty book it is. I mean, your movie's not about 50 Shades. There's no reason for you to make they basically made an ad for this shitty book.
But people like it. That doesn't mean they make them right. But and not to mention the dad of the star of the movie is in the movie.
Oh, God.
Which kind of makes it even creepier.
Ew.
You just not realizing that?
I just realized how
it's like Sean's old boy moment.
He's fucking a woman who is like, Don Johnson's having sex with a woman who's been turned on by a movie that his daughter was in.
You like what my daughter did? No. Yeah. How about that?
I know. It's not canon to this timeline, but nevertheless. But I mean, I don't think they don't have to say it's shitty, but somebody, one intelligent person in the movie should go, you know, this book isn't very good. It's sexy, but it's not very good.
Well, but really, just you have to have a guy in the movie that really? Or Stephen King can walk by and go, this sucks. This writing's awful. And then he can walk off screen. Show dogs.
Next.
Lord of the Rings.
Okay, fine. Raja Gosnell directed this, the director of Smurfs and Scooby-Doo and Beverly Hills Chihuahua. Does that tell you enough about this movie? It's got Ludacris as an undercover dog and Will Arnett as his human partner. And they're going undercover at a dog show filled with talking dogs. Then they're talking pigeons. And this movie is not funny. And the special effects are terrible. Will Arnett is trying way too hard. His effort is well above the level of this movie. Just don't see this. Don't support this. Don't take your kids to it. Unless you hate them. If you hate your kids.
Okay, I got a question.
Yeah.
Do you take your kids to Deadpool 2 or Show Dogs?
Ooh.
That's a fair question.
Man.
Kid will probably see Deadpool 2 before Show Dogs. If he ever sees Show Dogs.
I mean, at least in Show Dogs, they'll probably be running around the theater doing other shit. They're going to stand up. They're going to run around. They're going to bring toys and play with those instead of watching the movie. I'd still say Show Dogs. Because Deadpool's going to make them think thoughts that they shouldn't have yet.
No, they won't understand it enough to have those thoughts, depending on the age. Box Office Mojo should require a budget. I want to know what this movie cost to make.
$10. It was about $10, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, they made $6. Same with Book Club. Give me a budget. come on, Avengers, put your budget in here.
You can go into the IMDb page and find the budget for it.
Too much work. I like to see the gross next to the budget. Plus, we're live on the air. Or not live on the air, but I don't want to edit this out. So I'm just going to leave it.
Yeah, Book Club and Show Dogs. I mean, that neither one is Maze Runner bad, which is the standard bearer this year. If you've been following my Ranking the Movies column, Maze Runner remains right there at the bottom. The Greasy Strangler not far above that.
That's not fair. He didn't finish it. It got really good.
I think I might watch if I was putting it to, if you asked me, like you put a gun to my head, you got to watch one or the other, I'd probably watch Greasy Strangler before I watch Show Dogs again.
You have Sherlock Gnomes above these movies?
But Sherlock Gnomes was more inoffensive. I didn't care for it, but.
Truth or Dare?
Truth or Dare sucked really bad, yeah.
Overboard?
Overboard sucked real bad, yeah.
Wrinkle in Time. All right, our undisputed classic this week, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized undisputed classic.
And I think what everybody's wanting to hear is your reaction, Bob.
Oh, I didn't watch it. I bought it just to pretend like I watched it, and then I went to Wikipedia and read about it.
No, listen to a bunch of music.
I did make a playlist I never listened to, which I found hilarious. Is that, you know, you have all these bands from the late 60s, early 70s that are really inspired by Tolkien. And then, like, Megadeth has a song inspired by the movie because he's such an incredible lyricist. He has to, he doesn't read books. Anyway, I don't care about, was it Middle Earth movies or kind of fantasy wizard movies. That said, you have a bunch of good actors in it. It's fine. It flows good. It didn't really feel like 3 hours. It's good.
Stop. It's a positive review.
My review from day one with Lord of the Rings, I've seen this one before, is it's good. I just don't care. I mean, I will say that watching Viggo Mortensen fight, oddly enough, what popped in my head was I'd rather watch him fight naked.
Eastern Promises memories?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's kind of the one thing I was thinking about. And then, I don't know. I mean, you have great actors. I mean, Cate Blanchett's in this. Ian McKellen, Viggo Mortensen. And then, I mean, you even got, like, Liv Tyler is a solid actress. Elijah Wood's solid. Sean Astin sucks. But everybody else is fine. So it's a good movie. I like I'm curious about where we're gonna go with this and see the next one, because I like how, you know, the temptation the ring brings. I this is more of a critique of the book, I suppose, is, you know, it's kind of that Jesus Christ thing where, if, you know, the devil would never telegraph, hey, I'm the devil. And so Frodo's looking at them like, I'm not giving this guy the ring. But if, you know, you want to take the ring, you're going to disguise yourself better and be like, try to tempt him into getting rid of the ring. And I don't know, that's kind of my only real critique of it. But otherwise, it's a good movie. It's just long and I don't care about it.
Yeah, I've kind of always felt that same way. I appreciate the artistry of Peter Jackson, but I'm kind of like, what's in service of what? This is a very long movie, a very long series of movies, and the amount of time they spend trying to delay getting to where they have to get to, because they're making three movies, and the amount of things that are there because they're basically just fan service for the book fans, that's definitely a big part of this.
Well, and but I will say I think Peter Jackson's servicing himself too.
True.
With that. So I don't feel cynical about it. I feel like it's really a passion for him, and I believe it's genuine and real. There's nothing cynical coming. I mean, at least from what I've seen so far, I'm curious how that'll change or if it does at all. I mean, I do feel his passion watching the movie.
I do too. It's just some of it, like someone who wasn't so tied to the material might look at something and go, we don't need that. You know,
no, I agree.
Whereas a fan is going, oh man, I can't wait to see that on the screen. Is it really necessary to get you where you're going? And there's a couple of moments there where I'm like, not really. Not really.
That's probably true. But
you've got a solid point. Now, mind you, I've never read the books all the way through. And in fact, Fellowship of the Ring, I was reading with my son over a period of 4 years. And it started, you know, he's 11 now, when he was six or so. And we kind of gave up last year because it was just taking so long. We got to the Council of Elrond and things started to happen. I'm like, ooh, it's going to pick up after here, because my movie memory told me that, yes, the Fellowship starts out on their journey at this point. But no, we're still dealing with bullshit after the Council of Elrond in the book. That being said, is laborious as it is to get through the book, what I found in this movie from the very beginning, not having read the book, I went into it blindly, similar to the way I went into Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, having not read the books. And those two movies being a month apart in 2001, I think that's a good distinction to make there. Going in, I had very low expectations, but had heard good things from it. And over a three-hour movie, for whatever reason, that has always put a prestige into my head, like, oh, they made it 3 hours. Well, it could be Wyatt Earp, but it could also be Dances with Wolves. Okay, you know, Godfather. That's not good for you guys. But in this particular case, he has a passion for the material, yes, but it's also Philippa Boyens that worked with him on the screenplay and Fran Walsh producing it and helping with the screenplay as well, really bringing the essence of Tolkien, as I understand it, to the films. And giving it a little twist. Everyone in this film is serious and emotional, and all of their dialogue has consequences to it. You know, everything leads to the next thing. And they're all sold on it. It's, I think, really hard in a fantasy film to get all actors on board. And having watched a lot of extracurricular information on Lord of the Rings, I know that this cast was very, very close and still keeps up to this day. And you can see it in their performances. You know, as cheesy as it is when hobbits get together and they're all huggy and old boy and old Mr. Frodo and everything like that, there's a genuineness to it that I actually can wrap my head around. And that innocence, compiled with the fact that the world could end because massive evil is lurking, creates what is really a timeless type of story. Yes, this is the first part of it, but this is just a different version of the same kind of story we've been familiar with since the Bible, in essence. I'm glad that you brought up the Jesus Christ comparison, because I, for the first time, believe it or not, this time saw Frodo like, oh, well, you know what? If you liken, because I always thought he was a little moody in the Fellowship of the Ring and Two Towers and whatnot. Like, why do you have to do that? But in the comparison to the story of Jesus Christ, his the burden that he feels of having this immense evil hanging over him is balanced by how pure and good he is. And then I started to understand more what his journey is like, and how Elijah Wood has such expressive facial expressions, I should say. And it really helped me identify with him a little bit, because he's got such a range of emotion in his eyes, and so does Viggo Mortensen, and so does Sean Bean, and Orlando Bloom, too. Like, all of these characters really work well together. Liv Tyler, I have never seen her in anything that I've really liked her in, except for the Aerosmith videos. And in this particular case,
that didn't creep you out at all. She's on stage taking her clothes off while her dad's on stage grabbing his
clothes. Yes, like later. At the time, I'm like, Alicia Silverstone and Liv Tyler are fantastic.
True, I agree.
you know, you did too. So,
I hate that song, though. Anyway, continue.
Me too. But she is so good in this movie and in this entire series. And she's so genuine with everything that she expresses, and in her words are so filled with breathiness that might not work, but it all works for me emotionally. Like, I've seen this movie probably 10, 11 times. Okay. I've watched the extended version, of course, this time, which what it does is add extended moments with Galadriel in Lothlorien, the glowing elf village or whatnot. And that whole scene right there breaks up the pacing of the movie. Cut that out. We've got Galadriel at the beginning of the film. In The Hobbit, where they put her in those films, is like the best use of that character, because we know what she's capable of without having that whole deadening moment in there. So I'm going to admit that this film could make some changes. Okay,
I would also say, you talk about her being there at the beginning, that double voiceover to start the movie is interminable. We go from her voiceover to
Ian Holm.
Yeah. Ian Holm's voiceover without breaking, and it's like, oh my God, just get to it already.
Yeah, the extended version is actually worse because Ian Holm continues to talk about things that we have heard so many times before. And that's the other part of the extended version that makes a difference, is the opening takes so much longer to establish everything. And I was watching the film, I was thinking of Jackson as a director and comparing these films with something like The Lovely Bones, which is such a great, great movie. In that movie, it seems so plain compared to this. This is like Lord of the Establishing Shots. You've got to come in an angle to get you interested in people walking, okay? Because that's... they are walking, I get it, but that's not inherently interesting. So you have to zoom in the camera somehow to show you where they're at. And also the fact that they're all still there. That means, as a filmmaker, you have to jazz that up a little bit, right? And you can tell, I lost count after 20 establishing shots. I'm like, man, come on, do something different here. But at least he's consistent. I'll fall back on just the emotion of the film. It's heavy on that, and after watching it, this being the 12th time probably, I still felt that ping of Howard Shore's score and the specialness of the end of the film for me. I think it rings true because most films aren't this genuine. You may not like the material, but most films aren't this genuine. And I really buy into that kind of thing. And I like, of course, the fantasy aspect of it. I love Aragorn. Viggo Mortensen as Aragorn is one of my favorite all-time characters. I think it's great that he hasn't really done genre stuff other than this. Because it really makes him like Aragorn forever.
Stuart Townsend is my Aragorn.
Is he really?
He was the guy who had the job was fired.
Oh, I'm so glad they chose Viggo Mortensen. He's terrible. Wow. Whew, that was a close
one.
Job,
he was like there for 3 days and they fired him.
Good call, Peter Jackson. Okay. A side story from this, it's funny that I think that you guys will appreciate. He did not know it at the time, but as my son's watching this, we get to what seems to be an intermission, and the screen goes dark, and he's like, oh, that was so good. And I'm like, no, we got to put in the other disc. And he's like, it's still going. God damn it, kid.
your son also had some troll.
Well, and I won't call it troll because he liked it. He liked it more than I did.
Yeah.
And he's into this goofy shit. But he knows that at the end, he takes the ring and throws it in lava. Josh is dying over here. I apologize. He took a drink of water. I always do that to him. He knows that at the end of the third one, he throws the ring, and I just said lava because that's what he understands. When that didn't happen, he goes, why didn't he throw the ring in the lava? And I'm like, oh, there's still two more movies. He's like, so in the next movie, we're going to watch him walk to where the lava is? And then the third movie is where they fight and throw it in the lava. I'm like, I think so. I didn't finish the third one. I don't really know.
It's not about the end. It's about the journey.
And I mean, I will say this. I think fan service is important to an extent.
Yeah.
At the same time, if you're going to come at it from just strictly a critical eye without... you're right. You could cut this down and do three or four versions for the DVD, and that's really where you can make your money anyway. So I don't know. It's good. I guess I'd argue that I find Star Wars more watchable, but I like this better But I think with that they were just creating something, and I find just kind of bubblegum and popcorny. This one is an established book that has, and maybe it's just because it's, I don't even know why I'm giving this more credit, but there was just more
I don't know. The genuine word you keep coming back to is...
Yeah, yeah, it's of the earth. It really is.
Also, to a point I think you've made before in the show, is that when it comes to something this expensive, all the money is there on the screen. You can see where every dollar is in this.
Yeah, there isn't a lot of CGI in this first film. As we go on to the Two Towers and you've got massive battles and whatnot, and in Return of the King with bigger creatures adorning the battle and whatnot, yes, the CGI is heavy, but I think it's we'll get there. I think it's done really well. This happens to be one of the most successful franchises of all time as well. In a studio like New Line that was on the verge of collapse at that particular time took a chance in making this, and it was so successful that they're still around today making movies. I think that's significant to mention once we talk about the irresponsibility of film budgets and whatnot, at least this way. I'm going to argue that the reason that they made three films, not only is because there are three books, but also because they were able to stretch their budget out, and thus all of the associated dollars that go with it. We're talking about food budgets, actors' schedules, travel times, location scouting, all of that becomes spread out over time. And when you do that, it seems to make a lot more sense than one lump sum. And so I kind of get in a way, they end up, you know, tripling what their budget is in terms of the amount of money that it took in. They've had really great marketing for these films over time, too. Great trailers, great posters at first. The DVDs and Blu-ray releases have been extraordinary. The packaging is the best that I've ever seen, and I'm really into this kind of stuff. So I love the franchise, but I also think that it does give a crap about its fans and doesn't just offer them tidbits of re-released crap all the time.
I will say go ahead.
Sorry, I don't want to spoil that narrative, but New Line did go out of business. They got bought by another company after they defaulted in bankruptcy, and now they're just a nameplate.
Who's the troll?
I
know it's a fact, but
Well, you know, sometimes when you're on a movie podcast and you don't know the news, you have to make sure that the actual film critic knows the news. So I actually thank you for that. Feel free to strike that from the record, of course.
That takes a lot of time, though.
Right.
In terms of being cynical, I think the most cynical thing for me about it was when the DVD came out, it just kind of came out as a single disc DVD.
Yes.
And then, like, 3 or 6 months later, they released that huge 9-hour disc or whatever it was, box. That was a little cynical because everybody knew it was coming.
They did, but some people prefer the theatrical version to the extended version, which is the difference between the two.
No, I agree, but people also are, I want to see it right away. But I want that one too, and I got it. So they button bought
yes,
both.
Yes, the intro to the extended edition DVDs for Lord of the Rings Fellowship. He Which stated about have. How they didn't have the time to accurately produce all the information they wanted to give them. They're in the middle of production, right. Post-production on other films, so it made sense to me. I understand what you're saying.
I'm saying it makes sense.
I want to make sure that I get all the information in for the audience to decide.
I remember people being upset about it, though.
There still is a mercenary marketing aspect to that bare bones DVD that they released versus the major release that they did later.
You're right. I will also say this: I prefer having seen it again and with the first time with a critical eye this week. As much as I would have a critical eye, I prefer the theatrical version of Fellowship of the Ring to the extended edition. And I'm going to do the same thing with the remaining two films once we, you know, eventually get there. But it's exciting to finally get this onto the show. I appreciate it.
Well, I mean, at some point it had to. I will. I don't know how long do you want to drag this out. One thing that did pop in my head a lot was the Oscars and why this got nominated three times, which I don't feel is deserved. But at the same time, I know that's just me kind of. I don't know. I do believe genre pictures should get credit to an extent, but at the other time, I think they're. I don't know. It's like only the ones I like should get credit, but not. And this was one that I didn't feel it deserved to be, unless the years were bad. I don't remember, but I don't know. That's just kind of where I was with it.
Yeah, I think Hollywood has a thing where they where if somebody spends this much money and is successful, they like to reward it, and that is a sort of a cynical way of looking at it because it's supposed to be – the idea is we're supposed to be honoring the you know the best movie, not necessarily the best investment.
But at the same time, to argue that point against my own point is what they did is impressive, and there is an artistic element to what they did to accomplish that, but – I don't know. You look like you want to say something.
I was trying to think about what you said. The Fellowship, I always wondered, really? Best Picture? Really? And now with Two Towers and Return of the King, I said, yeah, okay. And great. That makes sense. I didn't necessarily think that Return of the King deserved a win. That's really hard to say. And against those 2003 films, I think once we looked back on it, I was like, oh, crap. You know, for example, I think... Wasn't Kill Bill one of them in 2003?
Kill Bill was not a Best Picture nominee.
It should be. I would have said Kill Bill over Fellowship of the Ring or maybe even Return of the King, Two Towers, too. You know, so I at least recognize that it's not an automatic, but I likened it so much to Star Wars because Ian McKellen was nominated for Best Supporting Actor as Gandalf in this, too. It was the first genre pick that I remember as like something that was legitimized in my head by the Oscars.
Well, and then me saying Kill Bill should be, or you know, I thought Sin City was the best movie of the year that it came out. It was a weak year for movies, but still, I'm not being fair. It's just one of those things that I'm sitting here trying to go, I guess it's a real, and I hate saying real movie versus, every movie's a real movie. Mm-hmm. It's not fair to even throw that label at stuff, but I can't help it.
It was up against The Pianist, against The Hours, Gangs of New York, and the eventual winner, Chicago.
Fellowship of the Ring was?
Yeah.
All right, Fellowship should be better.
Oh, sorry, Two Towers. Sorry, it was Two Towers. My apologies, I had the wrong year.
Yeah, I was thinking Chicago was a 2002 movie. So in that particular situation, I haven't seen The Hours, but it looks boring.
That's it, you're watching The Hours.
Meryl Streep doesn't make bad movies. Come on, man.
Yeah, you're gonna watch The Hours.
All right, before we get to 88, let's do our top fives.
Put your top five. Who's your top five
favorite movie props? Where do we even start? We have a ton this week.
One on Instagram.
Go ahead.
We have Ian, who contributed with his five. Walkie-talkie watch from Dick Tracy. Number four, stuffed toy bunny from Con Air. Hey. Three, dragon
put the
sword.
Bunny back in the box.
Man, eventually we're going to have to watch that movie. Number two is Babe Ruth's signed ball from The Sandlot. And number one is Joker's laughing box from the 1989 Batman.
All right. Man, Jason's, I should have. He said, PM me if you want an explanation, and I forgot to do that. Brad Rogers said, do not poke fun or tell me there's a sequel to ruin their masterpieces. I don't.
He was talking about Lord of the Rings.
Okay. Cousin Jeff, Freddy's Glove, Nightmare on Elm Street, The Maltese Falcon, The Maltese Falcon, Fertility Idol, Indiana Jones, Anakin's Lightsaber, Star Wars, The Glass Unicorn from Black Christmas. Jason from New Mexico has that little wand thing from Men in Black.
The Neuralizer.
Okay. Jigsaw and the Tricycle from Saw. That box, what's that from?
From Hellraiser, right?
Okay. is that a tongue on a knife?
It looks like an eyeball on a knife or something like
that.
Oh,
that's from Unchained Andalou. It's a legendary movie. Salvador Dali and, I can't remember the director now, legendary director, but yeah, Luis Buñuel. The razor blade slicing an eyeball.
Man, it's effective right there.
one of the most shocking. It was made in 1929. Yeah, and nobody had ever seen anything like it before.
And then he has that ball from Phantasm, I think. And honorable mention to the dildo from Fight Club. Scott Underwood, Highlander Clan McLeod sword, Highlander the Katana sword. Goodies treasure map.
I think he meant Goonies, right?
Yeah. Before, after Troy burns it. Harry Potter, the Elder Wand, and Han Solo's dice. Uncle Jeff has the newspaper in Psycho, the clown doll in Poltergeist, the titular instrument in the piano, the vial of eternal youth in Death Becomes Her, Sigourney Weaver's glasses in Copycat.
It's very specific, man.
If you want an awesome drinking game, take a shot every time she takes her glasses on and off. You'll be on the floor by the end of the film. That sounds like a bonus episode.
This podcast is ruining Sigourney Weaver for me. I swear, you guys
are trying hard.
Talking too. About Ripley all the time, and he's saying she's got a tick for the character that doesn't work.
We'll have to play the drinking game as a bonus episode or something. Yeah. Beth has number 5 proton packs, Ghostbusters. Number 4, Joanne's Tupperware from Home for the Holidays. 3, the Javelina, taxidermy boar's head from the Royal Tenenbaums, the rug from the Big Lebowski, the Time Turner, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Very good, Bob. Very good.
And then Ben has number 5, Captain America's shield, Kylo Ren's lightsaber, Indiana Jones whip, the hoverboard from the Back to the Future franchise, and proton pack number 1. Josh, do you want to read your book?
Yeah. I won't say any of the honorable mentions. I do have a lot, though.
But go to our Facebook page if you have some time to kill.
It was hard to leave some off. Number 5 is Glenn Hansard's guitar from Once. His character doesn't have a name. He's just called Guy. 4 is the hoverboard and the hydrator and the self-lacing shoes and all the cool things, including Gray Sports Almanac from Back to the Future 2. That's like prop central right there. I mean, they've been recreating that crap over time for us to buy since then. Let's see. Number 3 is Ripley's pulse rifle / flamethrower / motion tracker from Aliens. Awesome. 2 is the One Ring from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And number 1, I had to narrow it down because Bob was being an asshole. Luke Skywalker's green lightsaber.
He actually mentioned like every different lightsaber in the movie.
Well, no, just the 3 because they're all special, you know?
I didn't get the chance to publish my list, but I had a few that I had to mention. The Hattori Hanzo sword.
Yeah.
From Kill Bill, obviously. So I think it's a classic. The top from Inception. That is a classic right there. My number 1 was more of a personal one from Lebowski. Everybody talks about the rug, and the rug is awesome. Definitely a centerpiece. Really ties the movie together. But for me, the prop that always kills me, that always gets me, is that stupid car phone. Phone drinking, dude. Thank you, Donnie. Every time. It gets me every time. It's the biggest laugh. There's that, and then there's the dude's drink. Is he getting tossed in the back of the Lebowski's car? Hey, man, there's a beverage here. that cup is as funny as anything in any movie ever.
That used to be my ringtone until I noticed everybody. Well, one, when people had ringtones, but 2, when everybody else had phones ringing, dude. I was like, okay, it's not that original. Let's change it.
And I would also have to throw in Walter's The Whites. his drawers. That would be my other iconic movie prop.
I had number 5, the amp that goes to 11, and Mini Stonehenge from the William Miller's voice recorder from Almost Famous, the Buddy Christ statue from Dogma. I had the rug, but I also put Bunny Lebowski's toe. And then Rocky's meatpacking robe from the first Rocky. And with an honorable mention to Sherry Moon Zombie's jeans and the Devil's Rejects.
I thought about the box from 7 with Gwyneth Paltrow's head, but there's another great prop in 7, which is one of the
the dildo.
Yes, oh my god, with the knife on it. That is the most. That's one of the most shocking things. Like early in my life, seeing that on a movie screen, I was like, "You can do that in a movie?" That was pretty fucking incredible.
Number 18 in 1988. squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in 1988.
Yeah, 1988.
Okay, we have two movies. One of them called Call Me. It seems like Red Shoe Diaries on screen. I haven't seen it. I don't know anyone that has seen it. I couldn't even really find a legitimate review on it. Anyone? Anyone? Catch that on USA Up All Night at any point? No?
Not knowingly.
Not knowingly. Okay, that's the right answer. And also, Willow turns 30. It's the onus for making Lord of the Rings our classic this week. We had Willow as a classic or a discuss it or defend it on the show 3-4 years ago. And came to the conclusion, at least in my memory, that, yeah, I don't know. My memory of it now is kind of reignited by the fact that Ron Howard's been talking about the possibility of a sequel to Willow. I don't know how you get Val Kilmer back or Joanne Whalley or, gosh, the Bav Morda. I mean, I don't know if she still exists in some way, shape, or form, you know, and who's going to play a Laura Dern. And he's talking about how that would be the focal point of a new film. Willow does not have the cachet of Lord of the Rings, though. It doesn't have the cachet of most anything from that particular genre. And I think it's just not all that memorable, to be honest. It's cool in many, many parts. And I like Mad Mardigan, Val Kilmer's character. I really do. And some of the moments are genuinely gross, like the dragon or something with the bridge with the monster. That's genuinely interesting to look at. But like many Ron Howard films, they suffer from a lot of vanilla.
A happy ending.
Well, which falls into the vanilla category. Right. So I don't think it's as well remembered as I think he wants it to be remembered.
Safe, conventional, forgettable in many ways. The origin of this story, I think the part of what lacks in terms of its weight is that this was just sort of an idea that George Lucas had, and he sort of got Ron Howard on it, and the screenwriter, I think it's Bill Dolman, they just got together and sort of hashed this thing out without – and what part of what comes from that is that you do take elements from Star Wars. You do take elements from Indiana Jones in a way, and then, of course, you've got that very simple Christ biblical allegory of the kid being put on a raft and floated down the river. The story of Moses, I think, is that. I'm not a Bible scholar, but that very basic, obvious sort of thing that will come into it. I think when you're coming up with you're building a universe, and certainly it's impressive that you're able. What anybody can build a universe has certainly done more than I have. But when you do have that opportunity where especially Lucas leeches so much from other aspects. He's in many ways, he's kind of like Kevin Smith, only on a bigger thing. Because Kevin Smith likes to take pieces of other things that he's seen over the years, and that develops. He gives it a unique voice when he spits it out, but he's bringing together all those things. Tarantino's the same way, a real product of the things that he's seen. Lucas was that way, but his stuff is so much nerdier. and so much more innocent because it goes so far back to the serials of the 1950s with their tropes, and he likes to take some of that adventure and kind of tried to bring it forward, but he couldn't really bring it out of its time, and it doesn't become timeless that way. And Willow is sort of that. It's like the less accomplished sort of idea of what Lord of the Rings is, where Peter Jackson has a much grander idea of what he's doing. I think George Lucas just is kind of piecing things together.
Yeah, I mean, this is a nostalgia movie for me. It sucks that the only people that tend to really remember it or like it are our age, between 3 or 4 mm-hmm. years of us. Everybody else is like, what's Willow? But, I mean, I don't know. If, in hindsight, I might have made Black Root one of my top 5 props. I don't know. <that's> kind of...
yeah.
Kevin Pollak is one of the brownies was funny. To this day, my brother and I, somebody will say I stole his baby from you when you were taking a pee-pee. It's a fun movie. Everything you said is true, and it sucks that it's true.
Do you think that the first film would be enriched and come back into the public eye and kids would start to like it if they made a sequel? That's kind of what I was thinking.
Because when we did bring it back, no one wanted to watch it with me. No one stuck around for it. They stuck around for Labyrinth and Princess Bride, and I just like, why? I don't. I didn't really watch those movies as a kid, but
it is weird the level of cultural cachet that Labyrinth carries that Willow does not carry. It's kind of interesting.
I would watch Willow 100 times before watching Labyrinth, that piece of shit movie. I'm sorry, I'm so vile towards it, but man.
Did, people love Labyrinth.
I know.
Did we do... That was weird. Josh and I were talking before you got here. Did we do Labyrinth versus Princess Bride or Labyrinth versus Willow way back when?
Gosh, I don't remember, honestly.
Labyrinth turned 30 last year, and we talked about it in full last year for the first time. And Princess Bride turned 30 last year for the first time as well. I don't think we ever really fleshed them out. May have been part of a tournament of sorts. Our podcast scholar, Jason from New Mexico, would probably be able to help us out with that.
Or I could just find it. And
also true, but why would we do the work?
But yeah, I don't know. But everybody who likes Willow tends to be in that 3 to 4 age range between where we're at, and maybe even Sean's outside of that age range. I know, no offense.
I was 12 when this came out.
Yeah, I remember gluing a poster to my wall, and then when we moved, my dad went to take the poster down. I was like, what the fuck's going on?
Willow lowered your property values.
Also, Universal Studios property values, probably.
And then, like, Gwildor was in it. Me, man.
Yeah.
I don't know. I always have a soft spot in my heart for that movie. I guess that's the show, isn't it?
Wasn't there one more 88 movie?
Nope, just
those two.
Next week, we've got Solo, a Star Wars movie. And because of that, our top five is shittiest movies of all time. Figuratively or literally. And we're going to try to make this work. Our undisputed classic is Salo, 120 Days of... What is it again?
Sodom.
If you can find it, watch it with us. I bought a copy of it. We're going to try to either watch it together or pass it around. We're going to try to get this. Who knows? The week's young.
This was the original Two Girls, One Cup, right?
Well, I was thinking it. You said it. Usually that's Bob's job.
Oh, don't worry. There'll be shittier jokes next week.
This is not a comedy. If we watch it together, the thought was, would we be able to watch it in context? And then having seen it not that long ago, this movie is going to pull itself back into context no matter how hard we try. So I watched 15 seconds of it before the show, and there's already shit in a bowl. So, but it's supposedly a great movie. It's effective. That's all I can say.
It's part of the Criterion Collection, so it's not just like, no offense to the Greasy Strangler, but the point of that film is to leave a gross feeling with you.
Interestingly enough, though, of Pier Paolo Pasolini's movies that are available on Filmstruck, this one's not. He's got several films that are available, including several documentaries about how provocative he is, and Salo is part of the Criterion Collection, but is not streaming on Filmstruck. It's like Filmstruck's like, fuck you, we don't want that one.
So I had to buy on Amazon. Thank you, Patreon supporters. And now I'm on a list somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. I remember talking about that a long time ago. This is probably the most provocative film we've brought to the show, right? I mean, Cannibal Holocaust is, but boy, we kind of enjoy that. This is an endure session, right?
Raw. But, I mean, I know that was just me, though.
Yes.
But. I'm curious because it's hard to say whether I liked it or not because it was just a lot to take in. But supposedly it's good, so maybe this time around, because I had seen Cannibal Holocaust before. When we watched it again, I kind of watched it through the proper eyes, and I'm hoping that happens here. I'm hoping it's good. You know, I know there'll be fun shit jokes to make, but it would be awesome if we found something there that, okay, I get why this exists.
then if you watch that and want to cleanse your palate, so to speak, you've got Rambo 3. It also turns 30 next week. So there's that.
Finally, I've been waiting to see that one because I haven't seen... That was... I have seen that as a kid on... That was like the first actor I heard say fuck in a movie.
All right.
My dad heard it and he's like, yeah, don't say that. And he doesn't go to Vietnam, so Sean can't use that argument.
Isn't it like Colombia or something like that?
Oh, geez. I lost the joke. I'm sorry. Oh, no. I was going to say that if we can't get Salo, the backup is a Serbian film.
Which is just as easy to get as Salo. Now, that one I haven't seen, but I've always wanted to.
Cousin Jeff has seen it. We can ask him.
Well, no, yeah. He and I talked about it. Jason, and I were kind of doing a three-way talk about it.
Three-way bookend?
Yes.
All right.
And he was like, if I still had it, I'd get you a copy or something like that. I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was, I don't know. It's always nice to be challenged to see, can you get through this? It's not really what movie going should be about, but...
Again, it's kind of how I felt during book club. Like, I'm being taunted to get through this.
That'll be the question next week. Book club or Salo? Which one do you want to watch next?
Solo or Salo?
Well, for me.
The vanilla or the chocolate?
He's on fire. Stop now. Let's look.
Yes, please.
All right. Thank you, Patreon supporters. We'll start with Jason Bryant and Charlie Messing, our key grips. Our character actors, Josh and Christina.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effect level, Corey.
May the force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Dave Sievers and Uncle Jeff.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
If you want to be a Patreon supporter, ihatecritics.net/Patreon. Follow us on Facebook, subscribe to the show on iTunes, rate and review the show on iTunes. We'll read your review on the air. Subscribe wherever you can. Tell your friends. We really want to help grow this podcast. Whatever else there is, ihatecritics.net, Twitter, Critics Pod. We did the top five. Everything's done, so here's the music, and stick around for Flickchart afterwards if we decide to play. Are we deciding to play?
Sure.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. That's right, the three best
Are we? Do you want to do Lord of the Rings, or are you too worried we'll just shit on it too much?
No, I think feel free. It gives a good idea of where it would stand. At least maybe like a 5-10 film comparison.
Yeah, it'll. I think, what do they do, 10 or something like that? All right, let's see what we got with Fellowship of the Ring. Re-rank this movie. I wrote it down in the notes as... Lord of the Fitbit. I don't know. Is that a joke we made at one point?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know. Somehow I wrote it down.
Because of the steps. Oh, that's funny. That's
why. And see, it came back around and was funny again this time, too.
All right. Fellowship of the Ring, Army of Darkness.
Army of Darkness.
Fellowship.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all good.
Fellowship, Panic Room.
Fellowship, I guess. I like Panic Room, but...
Fellowship?
I agree. Fellowship, Alice in Wonderland, 51.
Fellowship.
Fellowship.
Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. Was it 51?
Yes.
Oh. Well, still, I still go Fellowship. Yeah, I was thinking of Johnny Depp, though, and having nightmares. That's why I responded so quickly.
Fellowship, Robin Hood, 2010.
Fellowship. Yeah, that really sucked.
Fellowship.
Yep. Saving your choice. Hail Hydra. That's what it says on the top of my screen.
Hydra runs flick chart? They're in everything.
Apparently. Okay, what is next? The Day After Tomorrow or The Fellowship?
Fellowship.
Fellowship.
This is going too well for Josh.
It's about to end.
Yeah.
Fellowship or Amadeus?
Amadeus.
Well, that's not fair. The better movie is Amadeus, but I mean, I watch Fellowship probably like 7 out of 10 times if given the choice. They're both the same length.
That's a good question. I think I would watch Amadeus if I'm being honest, but again, I'd probably watch Cars before either one of them. It's easier. Fellowship of the Ring or Alien 3?
Fellowship.
Fellowship?
Yes. Fellowship versus the first Avenger movie.
Avengers.
Avengers.
Fellowship. No, I'll go Avengers. We've moved the Lord of the Rings up to number 361. Movies ahead of it, The Sound of Music.
Oh, no.
Back to the Future, okay, Taken, yeah, Home Alone 2.
Not Taken.
Home Alone 2 is one above 12 Years a Slave, which is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is right behind 12 Years a Slave, with Gandhi and Amadeus behind that.
What?
The Jewel of the Nile, then The Avengers, then Lord of the Rings. We'll have to knock out Gandhi, Amadeus,
yeah.
12 Years a Slave here one of these days.
Get rid of a couple of those. Move Amadeus up where it belongs.
Yeah.
We're going to have to rock that Amadeus.
You're 3 for 3.
Really?
Oh. Way to end the show.